This program is intended for individuals who are blind or are unable to read physical print and is brought to you by CABVI's Audio Information Services team.
Hi, this is Tricia reading the front page of the New York Times for December 9th, 2024. The campaign by Syrian rebels to topple Assad was swift. President Bashar al-Assad had kept opposition forces at bay for a decade with the help from Russia and Iran, but rebels struck at a moment of weakness for those countries. By Neil McFarquhar. The government of President Bashar al-Assad of Syria, which had kept rebel forces at bay for more than a decade with Iranian and Russian military support, collapsed with astonishing speed on Sunday morning after an advance by opposition forces on the capital, Damascus. An authoritarian leader who had gassed his own people during a 13-year civil war, Mr. al-Assad fled the country as rebel forces closed in on Damascus. On Sunday evening, Russian state media outlets and two Iranian officials said he had arrived in Russia, where state media outlets reported that Mr. al-Assad and his family had been granted political asylum. The New York Times could not immediately independently confirm that Mr. al-Assad was in Russia, which, along with Iran, had helped keep him in power. The rebel offensive had lasted less than 2 weeks. And there are maps showing how the rebels increased the area they controlled over the 2 weeks. The Russian Foreign Ministry said Mr. al-Assad had, quote, decided to leave the presidential post and depart the country, end quote, after talks with, quote, other parties to the conflict, end quote. He had given instructions to transfer power peacefully, the ministry said. There was no comment from Mr. al-Assad. His prime minister, Mohammad Ghazi al-Jalali, stayed behind and said he was ready to cooperate with the rebels. The opposition forces swept into Damascus with little apparent resistance from the Syrian military, seizing control of government buildings and the state broadcaster. For years, the Syrian civil war, which had erupted in tandem with the anti-government Arab Spring uprisings in 2011 and continued with horrific violence until 2017, remained unresolved but relatively stagnant. Then in October 2023, Hamas attacked Israel, and the subsequent war upended the regional chessboard of the Middle East. The Syrian rebels struck at a moment of weakness for Mr. al-Assad's main allies, Iran, Russia, and Hezbollah, the militant group based in Lebanon and backed by Iran. Iran's power has been curtailed by its conflict with Israel. Hezbollah, Iran's main proxy force in the region, whose fighters had also played a key role in propping up Mr. al-Assad, has been battered by the war with Israel as well, with its top leaders killed. In Europe, the invasion of Ukraine has sapped Russia's military of men, munitions, and other resources. Waiting in the wings was Hayat Tahrir al-Sham, an Islamic group once linked to al-Qaeda. It later joined a coalition with more moderate partners, but is still classified as a terrorist organization by the United States and others. The group maintained its authoritarian rule over Idlib province in the northwest for half a decade, taxing residents to run its operations but following Islamic precepts to respect minority groups. About a year ago, it began preparing for a sweeping offensive toward South Damascus. The coalition, which analysts say received covert support from Turkey, established a military training academy in the north, churning out disciplined, highly motivated officers and soldiers, the analysts said. Quote, the revolution has transitioned from chaos and randomness to a state of order, end quote, Abu Muhammad al-Jalani, the commander of the rebel units, said last week in a television interview. Mr. al-Jalani's coalition launched its lightning offensive on November 27th, first taking Syria's largest city, Aleppo. The rebels went on to seize the city of Hama, which had never fallen during the civil war, and then Homs, a strategic city about 100 miles from the capital. Another group of insurgents from south of Damascus were actually the first to enter the capital. At times, the rebels seemed as surprised by their success as the rest of the world. On the other side, Syrian government forces had done little to rejuvenate themselves. Quote, they had low morale, no training, no weapons, no chain of command, and a lot of corruption, end quote, said Ibrahim Hamidi, the Syrian editor-in-chief of Al-Majalla, an online current events magazine based in London. Syrian government forces, without troops from Hezbollah and Iran to back them, and with relatively little support from Russian airstrikes, collapsed in disarray. Even the 4th Armored Division and the Republican Guards, the elite forces stationed around Damascus to, in theory, make it coup-proof, seemed to evaporate. Quote, we have seen the hollowing out of the Syrian state, end quote, said Mona Yacoubian, head of the Middle East and North Africa Center at the U.S. Institute of Peace in Washington. President Vladimir V. Putin of Russia had built his strategy of making Moscow a player again in the Middle East around his support for Mr. al-Assad, even as the Kremlin grew weary of his refusal to engage with Turkey, not to mention the opposition, to settle the conflict. Quote, it is a humiliation for Putin, end quote, Mr. Hamadi said. Amid the many conflicts of the Middle East, the United States had long had an ambivalent relationship toward the situation in Syria, wary of pushing for a regime change that would bring what Obama administration officials used to call the, quote, catastrophic success, end quote, of a jihadist government in Damascus. There are about 900 American soldiers in Syria, deployed in the northeast to back up a Kurdish militia there that had fought against the Islamic State militant group. Donald Trump had moved to withdraw them during his previous presidency, describing the country as, quote-unquote, death and sand. Now, as president-elect, he has repeated that the United States should not get involved in Syria now. It is not clear what kind of government will emerge in Syria, given the disparate coalition that brought down Mr. al-Assad, whose father first took over in a coup in 1970. Whatever the outcome, said Robert S. Ford, the American ambassador to Syria from 2011 to 2014, it is imperative for Washington, quote, to decide once and for all what is their primary objective in Syria, end quote. Other governments with stakes in the country, in the outcome in Syria, will no doubt also be recalibrating, as will groups like the Islamic State, which once established a caliphate in eastern Syria and has been resurgent in that desert region in recent months. For now, Syrians who opposed Mr. al-Assad were ecstatic. In what were long rebel-held areas, people delighted in finally being able to look at the sky without fear of bombs raining down on them. And residents of Damascus who lived through years of his oppressive rule expressed relief, but remained wary. Wala Salama, a mother of 2 young children, said she felt she was experiencing freedom for the first time in her life. But she added that she knows uncertainty lies ahead as the policies of a new government become clear. Quote, hopefully what is coming is better, end quote, she said. Want a job in the Trump administration? Be prepared for the loyalty test. Applicants for government posts, including inside the Pentagon and the intelligence agencies, say they have been asked about their thoughts on January 6th and who they believe won the 2020 election. By David E. Sanger, Jonathan Swan, and Maggie Haberman. The Trump Transition Offices in West Palm Beach, Florida. At the Trump Transition Offices in West Palm Beach, Florida, prospective occupants of high posts inside the Pentagon and the intelligence agencies typically run through a gamut of 3 to 4 interviews, conducted in recent weeks by a mix of Silicon Valley investors and innovators and a team of the MAGA faithful. The applicants report that they have been asked how to overhaul the Pentagon, or what technologies could make the intelligence agencies more effective, or how they feel about the use of the military to enforce immigration policy. But before they leave, some of them have been asked a final set of questions that seemed designed to assess their loyalty to President-elect Donald J. Trump. the questions went further than just affirming allegiance to the incoming administration. The interviewers asked which candidate the applicants had supported in the three most recent elections, what they thought about the events of January 6, 2021, and whether they believed the 2020 election was stolen. The sense they got was that there was only one right answer to each question. This account is based on interviews with 9 people who either interviewed for jobs in the administration or were directly involved in the process. Among those were applicants who said they gave what they intuited to be the wrong answer, either decrying the violence at the Capitol on January 6 or saying that President Biden won in 2020. Their answers were met with silence and the taking of notes. They didn't get the jobs. 3 of the people interviewed are close to the transition team and confirmed that loyalty questions were part of some interviews across multiple agencies, and that the Trump team researched what candidates had said about Mr. Trump on the day of the Capitol riot and in the days following. Candidates are also rated on a scale of 1 to 4 in more than a half dozen categories, including competence. Caroline Leavitt, the incoming White House press secretary, declined to address specific questions about the topics being raised in job interviews. Instead, she said, quote, President Trump will continue to appoint highly qualified men and women who have the talent, experience, and necessary skill sets to make America great again, end quote. Previous administrations, of course, have also been interested in whether new hires were aligned with the president's agenda. But the distinction between Mr. Trump's process and past ones is that the interest goes well beyond alignment on policy. The Trump transition team appears to be trying to figure out whether prospective hires have ever shown a hint of daylight between themselves and Mr. Trump on specific issues, particularly as he tried to revise the history of his final weeks in office and its aftermath. Mr. Trump has maintained that January 6, when a mob of his supporters stormed the Capitol, was actually an event filled with quote-unquote love. He has insisted that no one who was arrested was armed. Criminal indictments say otherwise. He has described people convicted and imprisoned for their role in the Capitol attack as quote-unquote hostages, and he has claimed falsely that the 2020 election was stolen from him. Charlie Kirk, the right-wing activist and pro-MAGA podcaster, is among those conducting the loyalty tests, along with members of the personnel team. That team is led by Sergio Gore, who has helped run the publishing company that produces the president-elect's books and ran a multi-million-dollar super PAC that supported Mr. Trump. The more policy-focused interviews have been conducted by members of the transition staff and by potential agency heads, such as Kash Patel, Mr. Trump's choice to lead the FBI, and Tulsi Gabbard, his pick to be Director of National Intelligence. For some applicants, the process was a jarring mix of substantive policy discussions and clear attempts to assess their fealty. 2 applicants said they were impressed by the quality of the questions on how to get new technology into the Pentagon or change the structure of the intelligence agencies, only to be shocked by the final questions. Quote-unquote traitors and quote-unquote snakes. Mr. Trump has long been fixated on the concept of loyalty, but past criticism is not always a deal-breaker. Vice President J.D. Vance once called himself a quote-unquote never-Trump guy and said Mr. Trump was quote-unquote unfit for the office. Mr. Trump's pick for Secretary of State, Senator Marco Rubio of Florida, once described Mr. Trump as a quote-unquote con artist who couldn't be trusted with the nuclear codes. Many of the people who worked for Mr. Trump in his first term, and to a lesser extent those entering his next administration, have said something critical about him at some point in time, given his hostile takeover of the Republican Party in 2016. But he has transformed the GOP in his image, and many of those past critics have now become vocal defenders of the Trump worldview. Mr. Trump has told advisors that his biggest regret from his first term was appointing quote-unquote traitors, some of whom came to view him as a threat to democracy. He has singled out for especially harsh attacks his chief of staff, John F. Kelly, who has called Mr. Trump a fascist, his defense secretaries Jim Mattis and Mark T. Esper, and his attorneys general, Jeff Sessions and William P. Barr. Mr. Barr is a staunch conservative who satisfied Mr. Trump right up until the final weeks of his presidency when he refused to use the Justice Department to help Mr. Trump overturn the 2020 election. Mr. Trump had grown convinced that the quote-unquote deep state was out to get him during his first impeachment trial, which focused on his effort to pressure President Volodymyr Zelensky of Ukraine to investigate the son of his political rival, Joseph R. Biden Jr. He became fixated on the bow tie wearing State Department official George Kent, who testified against him. Mr. Trump demanded to know how someone like Mr. Kent, who would offer unflattering testimony, could be working in his government. At the time, Mr. Trump brought back into the White House his close aide and quote-unquote body man, John McAtee, to serve as his loyalty cop. Mr. McAtee had no experience in government hiring, but Mr. Trump appointed him in early 2020 to take over the powerful presidential personnel office, giving him the specific task of finding and firing the quote-unquote snakes. Mr. McAtee got to work fast. He and his team incorporated a questionnaire designed to test loyalty in the hiring of government employees. As they were doing that, Mr. Trump's lawyers were quietly working on a plan called Schedule F that would make it much easier to fire career civil servants. Such employees have protections to keep a stable level of expertise from one administration to the next, regardless of whether the presidency switches from one political party to the other. Mr. Trump's allies have made clear that Schedule F will be brought back in his second term. How a criminal with close ties to China became a New York power broker. John Chung was a Chinatown gangster before remaking himself into a powerful force in New York politics, one closely aligned with the Communist Party. By Michael Forsyth, Bianca Polero, Jay Root, and Benjamin Weiser. On a Monday in March, in the heart of China's capital, more than 2,000 delegates of a rubber stamp advisory board to the authoritarian government of President Xi Jinping gathered for their annual meeting. One mission of the men and women in attendance was to spread the global influence of China's Communist Party. Of the throngs of party officials, generals, and business executives who watched as Mr. Xi took the stage, just 20 people had been invited to represent the country's vast diaspora, including a single person from the United States, a 69-year-old man from Brooklyn named John Chung. Mr. Chung's participation reflected a remarkable proximity to the highest levels of power in China, experts said, and marked him as a person on whom the country's leaders might call for favors. But it was remarkable, too, because of his position at home. He has operated as a power broker in America's largest city, with immense sway over an important subset of New York politics. For years, Mr. Chung has exerted influence over the city's ethnic Chinese communities, reaching into back rooms and political clubhouses from Sunset Park in Brooklyn to Manhattan's Chinatown, to Flushing in Queens, to help sway elections, all without drawing much attention. But lately, federal investigations into foreign influence efforts have swirled around city and state government in New York. Mayor Eric Adams has been charged with conspiring to accept illegal foreign campaign contributions from Turkey. He has pleaded not guilty. One of his top aides, an Asian affairs director with ties to China, had her homes searched in an investigation by Brooklyn federal prosecutors who have separately brought cases against people they suspect of being Chinese agents. The same prosecutors recently accused an aide, to Governor Kathy Hochul of serving the Chinese government by blocking Taiwanese officials from the governor's office. Mr. Chung, now 70, has not been accused of any wrongdoing in the investigations. But against the backdrop of recent events, he has stood out nonetheless, both for his overt connections to the Chinese government and for his ability to influence American elections up and down the ballot. He has done it in part through a network of nonprofits that he and his allies control, directing money, staffing, and votes to his favored candidates, and organizing demonstrations against anyone opposed to Mr. Xi or his policies. His targets have been politicians on either side of the aisle who might be perceived as acting against the interests of the Chinese government, records and interviews show, by supporting Hong Kong's anti-Beijing protests, for instance, or attending a reception for a visiting dignitary from Taiwan, the island democracy that China claims as its own. Just weeks ago, he helped unseat a Taiwan-born Democratic incumbent in a state Senate race in Brooklyn. It was the only Senate seat in the Democrats lost this cycle. And in 2022, Mr. Chung's support for a little-known congressional candidate in New York City probably influenced the outcome of the Democratic primary in the race, leading to the defeat of a Taiwan-born state assemblywoman. Mr. Chung did not respond to repeated requests for comment, and he eventually declined through his lawyer to answer written questions sent in English and Chinese. Officials who have gotten on his bad side described him as a daunting political foe. Quote, "I've never seen a Chinese American go abroad and sit in these meetings that are openly CCP-driven and then come back and brag about it," end quote, said one of those officials, State Assemblyman Ron Kim, a Queens Democrat, using an acronym for the Chinese Communist Party. Quote, "This is a whole different level of brazen propaganda," end quote. Mr. Chung has participated in trips to China, paid for by his business association and with the support of the Chinese consulate, with more than a dozen state lawmakers and business executives. The most recent occurred last December. Such trips are not illegal, and local, state, and federal lawmakers have been making similar journeys for years. Still, the Beijing meeting that Mr. Chung attended in March was a session of the Chinese People's Political Consultative Conference, the top organization in China's United Front System, a network of groups that seek to deepen the Communist Party's influence inside China and globally. In New York, Mr. Chung founded a business association, a Brooklyn-based nonprofit advocating Asian American rights, and a group for people from his hometown in China. They have helped promote Beijing's political agenda, according to a New York Times review of Chinese language articles and videos, which identified dozens of events in New York City and attended by Chinese officials. Besides the trips Mr. Chung led to China, he has also appeared at several events with Ms. Hochul and Mr. Adams, most recently mingling with the mayor at a Brooklyn festival in February. Throughout it all, perhaps the most extraordinary element of Mr. Chung's rise to prominence in New York politics was not his ties to the Chinese Communist Party, but a part of his personal history he has taken pains to hide from his supporters, that he was a felon, having pleaded guilty in another life to human smuggling and heroin trafficking. From smuggler to informant. When he first arrived in New York City more than 30 years ago, Mr. Chung had already been a member of a Chinese crime organization. As a young man in the 1970s, he had escaped the poverty and chaos of China under Mao Zedong by sneaking into Hong Kong, then a British colony. There, he joined a gang, according to a 2022 Chinese language profile, in which he was interviewed at a Brooklyn restaurant he owned. Emigrating to New York, he joined the Wo Li Kong Triad and got into the lucrative business of smuggling Chinese citizens into the United States, court documents show. In China, such smugglers are known as quote-unquote snakeheads, and at the time they charged about $40,000 per person for the journey, with the migrants usually routed through other countries before arriving in the United States. At the same time that he was running his criminal operation, Mr. Chung was emerging as an important figure in New York's Chinese immigrant community, as a restaurateur and as an activist. In 1999, he organized a protest of the U.S. bombing of the Chinese embassy in Belgrade, Yugoslavia, which American officials said was a targeting error, but which many Chinese considered a deliberate act. In 2000, one of the companies he founded, a production firm, employed Winnie Greco, the Adams aide and Asian affairs liaison, whose homes would be searched 24 years later by federal authorities, records show. His rise was interrupted in July 2001, when he and three of his accomplices were charged with, among other things, smuggling Chinese migrants inside shipping containers at ports in Washington state. In September 2002, Mr. Chung, also known as Chen Xiaowang and Ao Yong, stood before a federal judge in Lower Manhattan and prepared to take responsibility for what he had done. He faced a potential lifetime prison sentence if convicted. But Mr. Chung also had information that could help bring down a murderous Chinatown crime boss named Frank Ma, whose hitman had once forced two men to kneel in front of a gravestone before he shot them in the head. One FBI agent called Mr. Ma, quote, the last of the Asian godfathers, end quote. In January 2008, after assisting investigators from jail for more than 5 years, Mr. Chung stood before the same judge again. Quote, I decided to cooperate with the government to begin to make up for the harm I have done, end quote, Mr. Chung told the judge, Denny Chin. Quote, if you allow me to return to my family, I will never again break the law, end quote. He had pleaded guilty to a charge of racketeering that included human smuggling and trafficking more than 3 kilos of heroin and another charge of operating illegal gambling parlors. He was sentenced to time, served, and released. Mr. Ma was arrested and in 2010 convicted and sentenced to life in prison. At Mr. Chun's sentencing, Judge Chin noticed his, quote, extensive cooperation, end quote, in the case against Mr. Ma, quote, the results were quite good, end quote, the judge said. Quote, the Ma organization was dismantled, end quote. Through his lawyer, Joel Cohen, Mr. Chung declined to discuss his criminal past. Quote, the King of Brooklyn, end quote. Fast forward to 2014, and the United States Representative Grace Meng, a Queens Democrat, was issuing a proclamation that declared July 26, John Chung Day. Quote, since his arrival in the United States, end quote, Ms. Meng wrote, quote, Mr. Chung has pursued and exemplified the American dream, end quote. Asked recently about Mr. Chung's efforts to influence U.S. elections, she said in a statement, quote, I am totally against any foreign government influencing or manipulating our democracy, end quote. She said she had been unaware of his criminal record. The main vehicle for Mr. Chung's transformation was a nonprofit he had formed to raise the profile of Asian Americans in New York politics and call attention to anti-Asian hate crimes. Operating from his now shuttered restaurant in Brooklyn's Sunset Park, the group, Asian American Community Empowerment, and other organizations he founded, worked to help Chinese immigrants navigate the city's bureaucracy. Soon the Chinese language press was calling Mr. Chung, quote, the King of Brooklyn, end quote, and letters of support were pouring in from Hillary Clinton, Senator Chuck Schumer, and other prominent figures. From this perch, Mr. Chung has promoted his favored candidates and gone after those who displeased him. His effort to unseat Yiwen Chu was a prime example of both. As a newly elected Democratic state senator from Brooklyn, Ms. Chu attended a Manhattan banquet held by Tsai Ing-wen, then Taiwan's president, in March 2023. During the same visit by Ms. Tsai, Mr. Chung led protests outside Ms. Tsai's hotel and, speaking into a microphone, had said she, quote, will surely become a sinner for all eternity, end quote, an insult commonly used by the Chinese government. When Ms. Chu, who was born in Taiwan, came up for re-election this year, Mr. Cheng threw his support behind her Republican opponent, Steve Cheng, a former New York City police sergeant who was born in Hong Kong. He is not related to John Cheng. In an interview in September, Steve Cheng attempted to distance himself from Mr. Cheng, and his campaign manager noted he had returned a donation from Mr. Cheng. Quote, "If the man is associated with the CCP," end quote, Mr. Steve Cheng had said, quote, "the best we can do is remain cordial," end quote. Quote, "Can we be allies? No. Can we be friends? Sure," end quote, he added, quote, "but it ends right there," end quote. 2 weeks later, he joined John Cheng on stage at an event celebrating the 75th anniversary of the People's Republic of China. With a hand draped over the candidate's shoulder, John Cheng said to a crowd in Mandarin, quote, "You must vote for him and send him to the state senate," end quote. Steve Cheng defeated Ms. Chu on November 5th. It was far from the only race Mr. Cheng has involved himself in. He backed a candidate to run against Mr. Kim, a Korean-American who has represented Flushing in the state assembly for the past 12 years, this summer's Democratic primary. Mr. Kim, who had taken delegations to Taiwan and sponsored a resolution celebrating Taiwan Heritage Day, prevailed, but he said Mr. Cheng had made life more difficult for him by endorsing his opponent through several groups and fundraising for him. In another race for a congressional seat representing parts of Manhattan and Brooklyn in 2022, Mr. Cheng targeted a candidate, Yu Lingyu, who, as a state assemblywoman, had taken part in events with Taiwan officials. Mr. Cheng backed a lesser-known contender in the Democratic primary, who most likely siphoned off votes in the Chinese-American community. Ms. Niu's major opponent, Mr. Goldman, a former prosecutor who is an heir to the Levi Strauss fortune, won the seat and still holds it. And when Mr. Cheng wished to see another person take control of a Brooklyn State Assembly seat that had been held by Peter J. Abbott, a Democrat for more than 30 years, the incumbent's lengthy time in office served as little obstacle. Mr. Cheng supported his candidate, Lester Cheng, with donations and fundraisers, and Mr. Cheng, a Republican, defeated Mr. Abbott in 2022. During his time as an assemblyman, Mr. Cheng has led a delegation to China. The trip was attended by John Cheng and paid for by a business group he founded. After the election, Mr. Cheng took credit for the upset, bragging, quote, "We defeated the fool who had been in office for 35 years," end quote. Mr. Cheng did not respond to requests for comment. Celebrating, quote-unquote, the motherland. Along the way, Mr. Cheng has also taken to the streets himself, sometimes even clashing with Chinese dissident demonstrators. After the protest aimed at Taiwan's president in March 2023, he traveled to San Francisco last November to organize groups welcoming a visit by Mr. Xi. The demonstrations turned violent as supporters of the Chinese leader, including one of Mr. Cheng's close associates, clashed with protesters. Mr. Cheng was recorded while arguing with protesters, the Washington Post reported. On the same visit, he attended an invitation-only reception with Mr. Xi. In July, Mr. Cheng's nonprofit hosted a quote-unquote pop-up branch of the Chinese consulate in Brooklyn, staffed by four consular officials. Such unofficial outposts of China's foreign ministry are part of a quote-unquote gray zone of Chinese government efforts to reach into a diaspora community, according to a report by the Jamestown Foundation, which studies Chinese government influence. And after the arrest of the Hochul aide, Linda Sun, in September, focused attention on possible influence efforts emanating from the Chinese consulate in New York, Ms. Hochul called for the general counsel, Wang Ping, to be expelled. Ms. Chan threw him an elaborate farewell ceremony. Ms. Sun has pleaded not guilty. At a restaurant in Flushing, a crowd gathered as Mr. Chong led the council general onto the stage. They posed for photos with Lester Chong, the assemblyman Mr. Chong had backed. Mr. Chong praised Ms. Wong's tenure as a top Chinese diplomat in New York City and saluted the party that has ruled China since 1949. Quote, under the strong leadership of the Chinese Communist Party, end quote, Mr. Chong said in Mandarin, quote, the motherland has made tremendous achievements in the economy, science and technology, culture and stability, making overseas Chinese feel very proud, end quote. Top Gun Navy pilots fly at the extremes. Their brains may suffer. A confidential Navy program is studying whether intense fighter jet operations can cause devastating brain injuries in flight crews. By Dave Phillips, reporting from Coronado, California. To produce the best of the best, the Navy's elite Top Gun flying school puts fighter pilots through a crucible of intense aerial dogfighting maneuers under crushing G-forces. But behind the high-speed Hollywood heroics that the school is famous for, the Navy has grown concerned that the extreme flying may also be producing something else, brain injuries. This fall, the Navy quietly began a confidential project codenamed Project Odin's Eye, to try to find out. The effort will collect roughly 1,500 data points on brain function for each Top Gun pilot who flies the Navy's workhorse fighter jet, the FA-18 Super Hornet, according to communications by the project's staff. The goal is to understand the scope of the problem and identify pilots who are injured, the communications said. Some pilots say the effort is long overdue. In interviews, more than a dozen current and former Navy fighter crew members said that years of catapult launches from aircraft carriers and body-crushing high-speed maneuvers can take a cumulative toll. At the end of their careers, they said, some top performers become confused, erratic, and consumed by anxiety and depression. Pilots said the symptoms are routinely dismissed as unrelated mental health problems. In addition, they said, pilots often hide symptoms in order to keep flying. Some eventually fall into a tailspin. In the past 18 months, three experienced Super Hornet pilots have died by suicide. According to their families, all had symptoms consistent with brain injuries. Officially, the Navy denies that there is a problem. In a statement to the New York Times, a Navy medical spokesman said the Navy, quote, has no data or research to prove any relationship between concussive injuries and either air carrier takeoffs, landings, or routine combat maneuvers, end quote. Even so, for years the Navy has quietly sent pilots to civilian brain injury clinics and has funded research suggesting that the conditions crews experience in jet cockpits could cause brain injuries. Project Odin's Eye was created earlier this year to look for brain injuries in Navy SEALs. It expanded in November to include Top Gun aviators, according to project communications viewed by the Times. To quickly address a pressing need, the project began without formal approval from Navy Medical and Air Commands, according to a Navy official who asked not to be named in order to discuss the confidential program. Higher Navy command may not yet be aware of it, the official said. A Navy Special Warfare spokeswoman confirmed the existence of the program. For years, the Navy has studied how much force a pilot can tolerate in one flight, and generally maintained that brain injuries happen only when something goes wrong. But it has paid little attention to the cumulative effects of the hundreds of flights that occur within a career, and evidence has been mounting across the military that repeated exposure to routine operations can damage brain cells even if the operations go right. Most of the concern has focused on ground troops like artillery and mortar crews, grenade instructors, and Navy SEALs, who are frequently exposed to blast waves. If fighter crews face the same risk, it could have vast implications because of the Navy's huge investments in aircraft carriers and high-performance jets. The name Odin's Eye refers to a Norse legend about a god who sacrifices an eye to gain knowledge. Whether the project will find widespread injuries in pilots' brains is far from clear. Still, the fact that the Navy is now investigating shows that it is concerned about the risk. Quote, "No one is talking about it, but this is a big problem," end quote, said Dr. Kristen Barnes, who flew in a precursor to the Super Hornet, the F-14 Tomcat, as a radar intercept officer for 22 years, and then became a doctor. Quote, "When you launch from the carrier, you accelerate from zero to almost 200 miles per hour in 2 seconds, and your brain gets squished to the back of your skull. You can heal from that once. You can heal from it 10 times. But I did it 750 times, end quote. The human brain has a consistency similar to that of Jell-O, and it holds 100 billion neurons connected by biological wires so delicate that 150 of them could fit within a single human hair. Enough force whipping through the brain can cause those connections to tear. The brain can compensate, sometimes for years, by rerouting signals through healthy connections. But doctors and scientists who have studied the repetitive head injuries say the damage can build up, and if enough routes become blocked, normal functions veer off course. A decade into her career, Dr. Barnes started wondering why she was having so many problems. She'd grown sensitive to noise and light, and developed vertigo and heart palpitations, all potential symptoms of brain injury. By the time she retired in 2015, she was spacing out at work and forgetting entire conversations. She had always been a top student, but nearly flunked out of medical school. It was years later that a civilian doctor told her she probably had a brain injury. Quote, "For a long time, I thought I was the problem," end quote, Dr. Barnes, 55, said. Quote, "It never occurred to me that flying could do this to me," end quote. In aerial dogfighting, a jet veers and dives at more than 500 miles an hour, sending brain tissue on an extreme roller coaster ride that may tear connections between cells, several neurologists said. At the same time, the force of the turns drains blood from the head, potentially starving the brain of oxygen. Quote, "Those turns look graceful from the ground, but inside the cockpit, you are vibrating like crazy and fighting to stay conscious, end quote, said Mark Keller, who flew in the back seats of Navy fighters as a weapons officer from 1996 to 2012. In extreme cases, crew members can black out, but even in routine training maneuvers, he said, crews often, quote-unquote, gray out by flying so close to the limit that their vision fades to a narrow, colorless tunnel. Quote, "Obviously, that's not good for you," end quote, Mr. Keller said. Quote, "And I think it might explain a lot about what happened to me," end quote. By the end of his Navy career, Mr. Keller, once happy and easygoing, was getting into fist fights with fellow officers. After the military, he started smoking marijuana to cope with crippling anxiety and depression, and then began injecting cocaine. Quote, "My whole personality changed," end quote, he said. Quote, "I was completely unregulated and unable to make good decisions," end quote. Fighter pilots said they received little safety training education concerning brain injuries. Many are unaware of the potential causes or symptoms. Mr. Keller sought treatment for depression and addiction, but never thought to ask about brain injury. There are few publicly available studies on the neurological effects of flying fighter jets. Two of the most recent each found that pilots had described decreased brain function compared with control groups. Those findings match what some doctors who specialize in brain injuries say they have seen in pilots. Russell Gore was an Air Force flight surgeon before becoming a civilian neurologist. In 2019, the Navy sent him a half dozen fighter pilots who were experiencing issues with memory, clouded thinking, and anxiety. To him, they resembled veterans he had treated who had been repeatedly exposed to blasts. He took his concerns to the Navy in 2020. A doctor at the Department of Veterans Affairs, who treated several pilots in 2021, reached a similar conclusion. In a statement, the Navy said that factors other than flying may cause brain injuries in pilots and that, quote, no blanket conclusions can be drawn, end quote. The lack of awareness of brain injury risks in fighter squadrons may have allowed a number of pilots to fall apart without proper help. Captain Jake Rosales was a hotshot among hotshots. He aced Top Gun, became one of its leading instructors, and made the toughest dogfighting moves look easy. Quote, he was almost the perfect pilot, end quote, said Jeff Fellows, who was a fellow instructor. Quote, he could fly the jet to the very edge of the envelope, end quote. By the end of his career, though, after 23 years of catapult takeoffs and skull-shaking turns, Captain Rosales grew forgetful and depressed. The Navy had trained him to make quick, clear decisions, but he became so consumed by anxiety that even simple choices sometimes seemed impossible. One night in 2020, he went to the market to buy cheese for a family taco night, but he called his girlfriend upset because he was unable to decide which of the store's three shredded Mexican blends to buy. Quote, he was completely fraught, end quote, his girlfriend, Anne Marie Avani, recalled in an interview. Quote, the anxiety could be paralyzing, end quote. Unaware that he might have a brain injury, he began to see himself as a failure. In the summer of 2023, he died by suicide, alone on a beach near San Diego. At first, his death was widely seen as a tragic outlier. But then a second pilot died by suicide in January 2024, and then a third in March. All three were in their 40s. They all flew the Super Hornet. After the deaths, the Navy scrambled to ramp up mental health resources in fighter squadrons, but missed a rare opportunity to understand the physical side of the problem. There is no available test that can definitively detect the microscopic damage caused by repeated subconcussive injuries in a living brain. They can only be diagnosed postmortem by a few specialized laboratories. The Defense Department has such a lab, but no one thought to send Captain Rosales' brain tissue to be tested after he died, his friends and family said. Those close to Captain Rosales described a decline that neurologists say is consistent with brain injury. He started flying Super Hornets in 2003 and was chosen in 2007 to attend Top Gun. For 3 years, first as a student and then as an instructor, he flew high G-force maneuvers nearly every day, sometimes twice a day. By the time he was promoted to captain in 2021, he had flown 3,281 hours and made more than 400 carrier landings. But years of hard flying were changing him. He developed headaches and panic attacks, mood swings, and severe memory lapses. Lynn Rosales, his wife at the time, said she urged her husband to seek counseling, but Navy regulations can restrict pilots with a diagnosed mental health condition from flying. If he disclosed his issues, she recalled him telling her, the Navy would ground him, effectively ending his career. The couple lived apart for several years and divorced in 2021. Quote, I think the Navy failed him, end quote, Ms. Rosales said. Quote, he didn't feel he could talk about his mental health issues, so he white-knuckled them in silence, end quote. Several other pilots said in interviews that they too hid symptoms and continued to do so in civilian life because of similar restrictions for commercial pilots. Two men who flew with him were secretly struggling with similar problems. Scott Walters was a fellow Top Gun instructor who flew in Captain Rosales' back seat. Halfway through his career, he started having episodes where his heart felt as though it would beat out of his chest. He became depressed, started drinking before work, became suicidal, and was eventually forced to retire. Quote, I was really, really out of control, end quote, he said. Quote, I couldn't figure out what was wrong with me, end quote. Ian Gorski also flew in the captain's back seat. He developed unexplained anxiety attacks that made him vomit before work, and his thoughts began to skip around half-finished, he said, quote, as if I had 20 squirrels running around in my brain, end quote. He sought counseling after leaving the Navy, but said he never considered that he might have a brain injury. When told recently about Captain Rosales' struggle in the supermarket, Mr. Gorski started to cry. Quote, there's no way the man I flew with couldn't pick out cheese, end quote, he said. Quote, he was almost a god. No one was better. It makes no sense, end quote. Then, after a long pause, he added, quote, but I'm having a lot of the same issues. A lot of us are, end quote. If you are having thoughts of suicide, call or text 988 to reach the 988 Suicide and Crisis Lifeline, or go to speakingofsuicide.com/resources for a list of additional resources. That's speakingofsuicide.com. News analysis. Bogged down in Ukraine, Russia pays a price in Syria. With the fall of President Bashar al-Assad's Syria, Vladimir V. Putin has suffered one of the biggest geopolitical setbacks of his quarter century in power. By Anton Choynovsky. Lines of Russian troops in desert khaki greeted President Vladimir V. Putin in Syria in 2017. Declaring that Moscow had accomplished its mission in Syria's civil war, Mr. Putin pledged that Russia was there to stay. Quote, if the terrorists raise their heads again, end quote, he said on the tarmac of a Russian airbase, quote, we will deal with unprecedented strikes unlike anything they have seen, end quote. But over the last 2 weeks, as the rebels that Russia called terrorists swept across Syria aiming to topple one of Russia's closest allies, President Bashar al-Assad, those quote-unquote unprecedented strikes were nowhere to be seen. Instead, with Mr. al-Assad's ouster on Sunday, Mr. Putin has suffered one of the biggest geopolitical setbacks of his quarter century in power. He took that blow, analysts said, in large part because his military is bogged down in Ukraine. Quote, our involvement over there had a cost, end quote, a Moscow-based analyst focusing on the Middle East, Anton Mardosov, said, referring to Russia's war in Ukraine. Quote, the cost was Syria, end quote. By Sunday, Russia had been reduced from kingmaker to bystander. Its foreign ministry issued a statement of quote-unquote extreme concern about the quote-unquote dramatic events and announced that Mr. al-Assad had left the country. Dmitry S. Peskov, the Kremlin's spokesman, told Russian news agencies that he had nothing to add. Mr. Putin himself has said nothing about Syria in recent weeks. The extent of the fallout from Moscow of Mr. al-Assad's removal is still to be determined. The key question, analysts said, is whether Russia manages to strike an agreement with Syria's new government to hold on to its Tartus naval base and its Hammam air base, where Mr. Putin delivered that victory speech in 2017. Mr. Martasov said he was unsure whether Russia would be able to strike such a deal, given that Russia used those bases for overwhelming airstrikes against Syria's opposition after the Kremlin intervened in Syria's civil war in 2015. Losing the Syrian bases would thwart some of Mr. Putin's ambitions to reestablish Russia as a world power, since they are crucial to the Kremlin's ability to flex its muscles in places as far away as West Africa. Quote, Syria is their only real foothold in the Middle East and the Mediterranean, end quote, said Eugene Rumer, the director of the Russia and Eurasia program at the Carnegie Endowment for International Peace in Washington. The rebel victory, he said, has become, quote, part of the price they are paying for the war in Ukraine, end quote. The Kremlin is also likely to bear a broader cost to its image. In Mr. Putin's widening conflict with the West, he has been trying to position Russia as a decisive, reliable leader of global coalition against what he calls American hegemony. Quote, what good is Russia as a partner if it cannot save its oldest client in the Middle East from a ragtag band of militias, end quote, Mr. Rumer asked. Quote, besides the operational setback, it is also a diplomatic and reputational blow, end quote. Just a few years ago, Syria stood out as the biggest symbol of Russia's resurgence on the world stage. Its sweeping, bloody airstrikes bombed opposition groups into submission and turned the fighting in Mr. al-Assad's favor, sending the message that Russia was prepared to use overwhelming forces to stand by its allies and assert its own interests. The United States, by contrast, was increasingly seen in the region as an unreliable power that was disengaging from the Middle East. And after Mr. al-Assad's grip on authority seemed secure, Russia used its Syrian bases as a staging point to compete for influence with the West in African countries like Libya, Mali, and the Central African Republic. But after Mr. Putin invaded Ukraine in 2022, Syria plummeted down the Kremlin's priority list. Russia's bases in Syria became known as places where commanders who had failed in Ukraine were put out to pasture and as a draw for soldiers hoping to avoid the trenches of Ukraine. And that's all the time we have. This has been Tricia reading the front page of the New York Times for December 9th, 2024.